I have received two questions, and sometimes I wished I would only get questions I can easily answer. Here's one question that is really hard. Acts 15:20. How could the council include or consider sexual immorality with food polluted by idols, etc., strangled animals, especially as the motivation here is to maintain fellowship with Jews rather than obedience to God? If I understand the question right, is if sexual immorality had not been mentioned, it would be fairly understandable that this letter that is going out as advice to the Gentile churches would say, please, for the sake of not offending your Jewish brethren, abstain from food polluted by idols, abstain from the meat of strangled animals, abstain from blood. Why sexual immorality? Am I understanding the question right? Yes? The answer is yes. This is a real hard one. I'm not going to go into the issue of food polluted by idols. There's a big section in Corinthians on this whole question of food polluted by idols. How should we deal with that? That's very, very detailed and technical. So I'm going to confine myself to this, and I'm going to try to answer. Namely, that obviously there is a fruit of purity that is to grow in all those who believe in Christ. It is impossible to receive the grace of God and do as you please. Not because you are again to come under the law, but because the gift of love drives you to fellowship with God, and that includes knowing His will and being purified from the inside out according to His purposes. So there is a purification consequence to receiving God's grace. My interpretation, but I really want to be careful on this point here, is that sexual immorality is a part for the whole of purification. So that there is a signal here to the Gentiles, our decision, salvation by grace alone, does not mean do as you please and just carry on your Corinthian and Ephesian life. But rather it means there needs to be the fruit of purity. And just to illustrate that, we're referring to sexual immorality. That seems to be a very strong factor exercising the various Christian churches in particular as an area that raises its ugly head and establishes self-determination versus God's purity and grace. Not as a means of salvation, but as a fruit of salvation. And not to say that there are not other things, many other areas that need to grow in purity. So the real problem with what I've just said, though, is that sexual immorality is kind of put in the context of these other references of fellowship. So I'm a little hesitant at this point to really explain. There's this rather difficult phrase right afterwards, for Moses has been preached in every city from the earliest time and is read in the synagogues on every Sabbath. But perhaps that simply speaks of the law of Moses is known. The instructions of God are known in these various cities. So you need to be aware, Gentiles, as you have fellowship with the Jews, that there are some very elementary aspects that you need to, for the sake of fellowship, be concerned about. So I would take the mention of sexual immorality out of that list and identify it as part of the whole of purification that Paul obviously speaks about in many of his letters as a very important outgrowth of the grace we receive by Christ. So that would be my answer to this very difficult question, but I'm certainly, especially on this point, very willing to be instructed otherwise. Second question. is Peter's speech in Acts 15 another example of his finally understanding something he had been taught earlier, similar to his understanding of Psalm 110 expressed in Acts 2, or is he simply explaining these lessons he learned earlier? Basically, I would say he is a repeating of a lesson he has learned earlier, namely Acts 10 and 11. But in some ways, in Acts 15, there is a settledness. There is a clarity. There is a wonderful summary of that. So in some ways, I could say, yes, both end. There is again another example of how Peter has been brought into the fold of understanding by grace alone. But on the other hand, he has already learned that in Acts 10 and 11. So I would say a both end, but that as well is a good question. So, we are going to move exactly on time to lecture 12 and looking at Acts 17, 22 to 31. It is an equally short as highly telling speech in the book of Acts. One of the indications that I am absolutely convinced that the speeches in the book of Acts are historical and they fit that particular context so amazingly, unless these are eyewitness reports or reports from eyewitnesses that Luke passes on to us, I don't know what. Let's go with Paul to Athens. I have already told you in the sequence of events, in the flow of thought, that in chapter 17 there's a reference to Paul going to the synagogue. Isn't it amazing? So he reasoned in the synagogue with the Jews and the God-fearing Greeks. This is Athens. This is Acts 17, 17. Now, which place in the United States would intimidate you most? Where would you expect to have such sharp philosophers, such educated people sitting there waxing eloquent that you just kind of want to walk out backwards as you just have entered? You name it. Harvard, Yale, pardon? Wall Street, pardon? Supreme Court, San Francisco. Okay, so you fill in the blank. I say Athens, then. If you want to avoid a place where people just know a little too much for comfort, Athens. Not Rome. Oh no. In Rome, they build airplanes, they have banks, they work on computers. But in Athens, they think. In Athens, they have refined their skills of rhetoric. A good speech is one that convinces. It has a well structured flow of argument that is measured, that is weighed, that is aesthetically appealing. All kinds of aspects must come together to be convincing. It's Athens. So you don't go to Rome to be intimidated. You may be intimidated by metal there, by power, by influence, but not by philosophy, knowledge, and refinement, cultural refinement. So here Paul is. Goes to the synagogue, reasons with the Jews and the God-fearers. And then what do we read? As well as he goes to the marketplace day by day with those who happened to be there. Now that you need to understand differently to a mall. A marketplace in that time is the social center where everything turns and happens. Dealing and wheeling, hiring of daily laborers, there is an intertwining of commerce and enjoyment, a little bit of Paris cafe, street side life of sitting down and having a long talk about things and just forgetting about these negligible little incidental things like work and other obligations, one cafe after the next. So you need to imagine a very lively situation, and you're just one little flea in the whole works of the marketplace. And here Paul is, and he, nearly like Socrates, seeks to engage some people. What are you doing? What are you pursuing? So he is doing a little bit of a street debate. A group of Epicurean and Stoic philosophers began to dispute with him. Note, this is not on the Areopagus. This is not on in the council of the lawyers, the attorneys. This is on the marketplace. He just meets some of these philosophers. Some of them asked, what is this babbler trying to say? Now, isn't that flattering? What is that seat picker talking about? Literally, it's a seat picker. It's somebody who's just absolutely haphazard in putting thoughts together. I mean, he has no clue of how to really engage a philosopher according to their perspective. I think Paul could have, but he did not choose to do so. What is this seat picker all about? But somehow, he did capture some others' remark. He seems to be advocating foreign gods, plural. They said this because Paul was preaching the good news about Jesus and the resurrection. So Paul did not beat around the bush. He did speak about the truth of Jesus, probably, though, as the speech indicates, in a very wise way. Then they took him and brought him to a meeting of the Areopagus, where they said to him, may we know what this new teaching is that you are presenting? So from there he's taken to Mars Hill, most likely, which is a meeting place where about 200 to 300 people have space, against some researchers who claim the contrary. And it is basically a congress of lawyers, attorneys, that do not only debate issues of the day, but they decide legal problems of the city that lies a little bit below them and to the side, the Athens. So this is a court, but it's a kind of a mixture, a court of lawyers and thinkers. They happen to be Epicurean and Stoic in particular. Now, I have exaggerated a little bit when I said that it was Athens, the place to go to. Because actually, it was Athens of several hundred years before the time of Paul that would have been really the place to be at. Unfortunately, the high culture of philosophy in Athens had already deteriorated at the time of Paul to a certain point where formality was more important than content. If you could make a good speech, it didn't matter whether you were speaking for Kellogg cornflakes or something else. It sold. So that was a little bit of the degeneration that rhetoric took primacy or predominance over content and good communication of a philosophical system such as the Plato's philosophy or Aristotle's philosophy, or at least the system of questioning and inquisition that was Socrates' brandmark. So a little bit of that is happening, a certain deterioration in the communication, and also an heightened curiosity of just, let's hear what he says and how he says it. Not necessarily, let's seek how to explain the universe, Plato or Aristotle. Let's investigate. Should we go for the ideas and systematize the phenomena, Plato? Or should we look at the phenomena and maybe arrive at some system, Aristotle, which, by the way, is the father of the modern scientific system. It's Aristotelian, evidential, rather than idea-driven. That has lost its flavor a little bit, just to the curiosity. Let's just hear something. So this is a little bit of the atmosphere that Paul falls in. There is a haughtiness. There is a supremacy feeling. He obviously is not an Athenian philosopher. Who knows where this guy comes from? He does speak Greek, but that's about all. So there's this haughty, prideful attitude and a little bit of a superficiality at that point. The high culture had deteriorated a little bit to externals, to this kind of a form. Now, let's look a little bit at the two groups that are mentioned here, namely the Epicureans and the Stoics, to understand a little bit of what Paul encounters here as he preaches the gospel. What a task, isn't it, to go in the nest of a bunch of lawyers who also are Epicurean and Stoic philosophers have a good bit of rhetorical skill and finesse, and to go in there and preach the gospel of Jesus Christ. You see that here again we're coming up against the barrier of high tradition, high institution, the weight of courts, the way of privilege. It's just kind of breathing against you. Sometimes you get to certain institutions and you're just kind of taking a deep breath. You just don't want to come with this simple little gospel of Jesus Christ of Nazareth against this huge establishment. That's how I felt in some of the German universities, where the gospel is absolutely marginalized vis-a-vis the great history of philosophical thought throughout the ages. And you kind of just feel this powerlessness. And yet, little David, i.e. Paul, takes the slingshot and aims at Goliath. This Goliath of tradition, establishment, weight, immovability. And he aims and he hits the target. That's amazing, really. It's another barrier that we may overlook as we look at racial questions, ethnic questions, language questions, moving geographically. This is a big one. This is a modern one. This is very much one of privilege. So, who were the Stoics and Epicureans? Let's look at the Stoics a little bit. Stoics go back to Zeno, the philosopher, who instructed his followers in the following way. Now, there is, as I have said, some thought of content. So you need to kind of take my little characterizations, portraits, with a grain of salt. I'm just drawing, sketching things. I'm not refining what I'm presenting. You see here, as I present now what Stoics are after, that there is a good bit of reflection. What is the world like? The world is only material. It is a materialistic world view in which there is no outside God as creator of the space-time creation universe, outside and distinct from his creation. If you would find anything divine like the Logos intellect or the logosphere that the Stoics spoke about, it would be a force within this materialistic worldview. So it is a monistic worldview. There is not God and nature, God and Satan as an adverse power. There is one world and it's materialistic. There's a little problem. They were not stupid, those Stoics. And what Pascal later called the misery of man, what the Bible calls sin. The Stoics identified as basic drives of man that are really destructive to happy coexistence. There are some destructive elements within this universe which is closed, which has no God separate from its creation. There's something problem, and that is their basic drives, basic needs of man, and they seem to war against good purposes, destructive drives. The Stoics said, we've got to master those. How do we master those? There are two ways to deal with these basic drives of man. A, develop a solid apathy vis-a-vis those drives. Just reflect on the futility. Futility of sexuality, futility of power, futility of money. Think it through, for heaven's sakes, and see with an apathetic distance of a philosopher who's finally come to the heights over these low things that they're negligible. And then do one more thing. Discipline. Employ the method of apathy employ the method of discipline, let them work together, and master these horrible things that get in the way of a life, of an understanding of life that is corresponding with the good forces in nature. You want to bring yourself in accord with the good forces in nature. You want to be in harmony with nature, with the laws of nature. So you bring yourself into this system of apathy and discipline, therefore the later term of this man looked stoically at such and such, we use the adjective. Therefore the great attraction to the Roman Empire, the aristocracy in the Roman Empire of Stoic philosophy, structure, discipline, order. I think the Prussian Germans studied a lot of Stoic philosophy. I'm convinced of it. I can't prove it, but I'm sure they did. So I can really blame Zeno for the Prussian discipline. That's great, wonderful, you know, to place the blame somewhere else. So this is the way to handle it. This is the way to master it. So there's apathy and discipline. Now the Epicureans shared the materialistic worldview and shared the understanding that there's a problem. But they differed with the answer. And that's why they were a distinct group, and not, as general understanding has it, that Epicureans were those who said, just live it up. Can't help it anyway. Just let it all hang out. That's not true. The Epicureans said this: things in themselves aren't bad, but use them in moderation. It's like, don't suppress, don't have the apathy and the discipline, just kind of manage it gingerly along. Your drives, your desire for power, your materialistic greed, just kind of manage it to a harmony. Because you know what? Real happiness is not achieved by just succumbing to these drives. Ride them like horses. But it's not just go with them. It's moderation. It's balancing them nicely, playing them like an organ. So it's actually the word harmony that is the key to understanding Epicurean philosophy. But you see that there are wonderful points of contact, aren't there, between the gospel of Jesus Christ and the Stoic philosophy, the Stoic understanding. You just have to accomplish a few things first, and that's what the speech of Paul does in Athens. A few things have to be established first, especially this materialistic, immanent understanding of reality. Because if you do not know God, you're lost. You're lost in this moor of dealing with your own fallenness, trying to pull yourself out, be it with Stoic philosophy or Epicurean moderation. Unfortunately, there are some people, I know one, in the churches, and I won't name names, but his name is Hans Beyer, who falls to the Stoic way or the Epicurean way of handling the fallenness of man, rather than the gospel, which says, impossible, no way. This is idealistic philosophy. This is rubbish. When you really realize the fallenness of man, you will be brought to your knees and to call out to the Lord and say, Lord, save me or I'm lost. You see, this is all nice game, but it really doesn't cut the mustard. That's why Stoics need to hear the gospel. That's why Epicureans need to hear the gospel. And we've got a lot of Stoics and a lot of Epicureans. Those of German descent are Stoics. Those of French descent are Epicureans. And they coexist happily, but they need the gospel. Because the gospel says, you know what? This is much more serious than you thought. There's a real problem. It's not just a little problem. There's a real serious problem. And that is, this is energy gone mad. And the reason this energy has gone mad is because the initial connection to the authority of God has been broken, has run its own course, done its own thing, has become its own idol, has its own momentum, its own laws, and you will not tame it unless it is brought back under the God who is outside of this materialistic world, rather than like trying to find therein some kind of an order to make sense, either for the Stoics to conform with the laws of nature, or for the Epicureans to have a certain harmony to coexist with this. So it's highly modern, obviously, nothing new under the sun. If you would go down to Union Station and say, are you a Stoic or are you Epicurean, they'd probably stare at you. But if you talk with them how they go about life, some person would say, you know what, I cannot commit adultery because that would ruin my law firm. Do you understand? There's a morality, there's a sense of conforming, there's a certain understanding, there's some thinking, philosophical thinking, if I do this, I'm going to be ruined. The only thing is, our society, I'm not pointing at the United States, our society in the West particularly seems to move beyond that to say, let's scrap this and scrap this and just let it all hang out. You know, we're all kind of in a mess and who knows what is true. That's really dangerous. A Stoic society is much better than a society that is outside of the Stoic or the Epicurean model. Which simply says, sorry, that's how I am. And I'm honest about it. So we've got problems. We've got major problems because a Stoic society at least has some reflection. It's not stupid. It will not fall into every little trap simply because it feels good. It will say, wait, if I walk there, I'm going to be flat on my face. I won't do it. But it's not gospel-driven, but it's fear-driven. It's disadvantage-driven. It's I will lose out here if I do this driven. But at least there's some brains to it, but no solution. No solution. So you must come to the gospel. How does Paul bring the gospel to these Stoics and to these Epicureans? We don't have a whole lot of time, but I will try to present to you how Paul structures his approach to the Stoic and Epicureans in Athens. Now, I would also want to say that I am not convinced that there are only Stoics and Epicureans sitting in his audience as he begins to speak. A clue to that, or a cue, is that he addresses people who believe in all kinds of gods, plural. And see, the Stoics thought it was really a good idea to believe in one logic, unifying truth within this materialistic understanding. I'm not breaking out of that suddenly, but some one unifying energy rather than all these fancy gods. I think somebody once counted all the gods and came up with 33,000 gods in Athens. I don't know, I haven't verified that number, but I think it's approximately right. So there was a third group, I believe, sitting in Paul's audience, and those were more of the popular conviction. Maybe they were lawyers, but they were not of the Stoic or Epicurean conviction. They had more of the popular pagan beliefs in many gods. And you know, there were some stones dedicated to unknown gods. There's still a debate whether there are stones dedicated to an unknown god or to unknown gods, but I'll leave that by the side. Why? 33,000 may have missed one, and he's going to be angry with you. He's going to be jealous. You did not establish a stone for him. So, just to be sure, just to be safe, let's dedicate a stone to unknown gods, so that all those whom we may have overlooked may not be jealous and feel overlooked, that we appease them. That's the whole sense of appeasing. Back from the Olympian gods to this very late stage in Greek mythology and religious feeling, there's this sense of appeasing the arbitrary, capricious sense of the gods. So, just as Paul moves in and addresses the Athenian court, I believe there are some of those. And Paul begins with a captatio benevolentiae, the address to his hearers. from the rhetoric, it is clear that you must not flatter your audience more than is right, nor less than is right. And this seems to be about right, from what we know elsewhere, that there needs to be some kind of a pleasantry presented. Paul says, I see that in all things you're very religious. Now you can take it as superstitious or seeking after religious truths, whatever that means. Leave it vague. You take your pick. Paul probably means you're superstitious, but this is a choice word that does not offend. I've seen you have a dedication to an unknown God. Ignorance. Let me tell you about this unknown God. Obviously, that unknown God was dedicated to somebody, who knows who, and Paul is presenting the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the father of Jesus Christ. Three parts mark his address to get at the Stoic and Epicurean and perhaps the popular understanding of these Athenians. First part of the Areopag speech in verses 24 to 25 addresses the relationship of God to his world. God and the world, God and creation. The second part in verses 26 to 27 pertain to the relationship between God and man. God and man. And the third section, you see these are just two verses each, so it's a very concentrated type of a presentation. 28 to 29, verses 29, relate to the relationship between man and God. So God to creation, God and man, man to God. I can actually use arrows, because there is a dynamic, there is a movement of how does God relate to his creation, how does God relate to man, how does man relate to God. You see already from the structure that there are various factors established that deal squarely with the basic flaws of Stoic philosophy. Not, you know, Paul doesn't pick a fight and says, you know, you guys with your apathy, that just won't work. At some point, that's probably going to come in. Or your discipline thing, you know, we've seen it with the Prussians, they just didn't manage it. They failed utterly, which is an anachronistic reference. So, Paul establishes some basic truths, namely, there's a creator God distinct from the world. God has made man, and the only appropriate response of man is to worship God and not idols. It's a very simple summary of the argument, but you see how this is being dealt with so that then you can deal with the problem of how do we live, what do we do with our fallenness, how do we handle our lives, how do we fit in to this. But see, if you don't have this basic truth, you will get lost here, because you will always move in your own circles and try to improve yourself. So this is fantastic how Paul establishes a basic line, and as some exegetes, some interpreters of scripture have said, that Paul preaches to the Athenians with point of connection, point of difference at every point. So this is an amazing point of connection, appealing to some things that either the Stoics or the Epicureans or the general populace could nod and say, amen, I've always thought that. And at the same time feel the knife that says, wait a minute, no, that's too close for comfort, I can't handle that. So it's an amazing speech that does not, you know, hit you over the head, but still it challenges the Stoics and the Epicureans in a fundamental way. Namely, God has made his world. He has made his world in such a way that man can live in this world. And God relates to man. He has made one man. There's a little bit of a reference to Adam and to the origin of all mankind from one. And that was a little bit of the Stoic understanding too. They had perhaps been influenced by Old Testament thinking. There's a little allusion there. And then the big point is, since man is such an important creature, how come that you make a little something out of wood, pray to it? You hope that it will help you. You hope that it will be strong enough to lift you out of your problems. Now you see that he has something for everybody in that group. Probably this idol area, the Stoics say, amen. Gosh, these superstitious lawyers that are sitting around here. Come on. I mean, this old-fashioned religion of believing. You know, so there's some nodding and some of this, probably kind of head movement in all kinds of directions. But the final point is this. Man is created for the worship of the living God. And guess what? This God has appointed the man, Jesus, to be, oh, your judge, you lawyers. You are going to be accountable to someone. Now, the great hope of the Stoics was to die and then to be freed of this physical limitation and somehow evaporate into the sphere of the ideas. So to hear of the resurrection is about as bad as anything, because it's coming back into the body and with all those problems. I mean, come on, don't preach the resurrection of the body. But that's exactly what is happening. And the only problem is, if you reject everything that Paul has said, he pronounces that every Epicurean and Stoic philosopher in that audience will have to stand trial of the one that Paul is preaching. So you have an option. You can say, well, this is a seat picker, all right. Bad rhetoric. Really bad content. Let's see who is next. Or you get so penetrated with understanding that really we are creatures and really the world is created by God, and maybe there is somebody that will hold me accountable, I better listen to this. This cuts to the quick. Let's forget about rhetoric. Let's forget about presentation. I need to hear. Some did. Some were affected exactly in that way. And they could hear about Christ. And then I'm sure Paul sat down and explained to them the gospel of victory over the sin by being a bondservant of the living God and worshiping Him. So this is a wonderful way how the gospel is being brought into the Yale and Harvard and MIT and whatever else high tradition of the ancient world, and how Paul is able to cut to the heart of the matter of these needy Epicureans and Stoics. Number one, I will not be here. I have a method of somehow scheduling, making my schedule that I'm not here during exams. And it's very simple. I like to write vicious exams, but I do not like to get the flack from students. So what I do is I hand those exams to my dear secretary, Deborah Kim, and ask her on my knees whether she would have the graciousness to proctor those exams, to which she said kindly, yes. And so I handed her the dynamite that she will pass out to you, and it will be handed to you. And then you can complain to her if you so desire. I will be far away, so I will be safe. But having said all of this, it is not as bad as it all sounds. The truth of the matter is that I will not be here. Please come at 6 o'clock, as usual. And then I will allow a maximum of 1 hour and 30 minutes. So please do not give my secretary a hard time. Unless, I haven't discussed that with her. Unless your primary mother, father, home tongue is not English, then you do have the right to have a little more time. So I need to discuss that with her. But if you claim that just because you're from Nashville, Tennessee, or from Michigan, that will not work. Okay? So, 1.5 hours, please come on time, and you will be dismissed after that. There will be no lecture or anything, so when you're done, you're done. I would suspect that the average time for completing the exam will be at the most an hour. So an hour and a half is quite ample. The format of the exam, well, first the content of the exam will cover what we have had thus far. I know that some of you are a little struggling with the reading. I was aware that you would have a little bit of a hard time with the Marshall book. I think it will be a little easier when you come to F.F. Bruce. I want to console you if that is a little hard. Your main focus on review, your main focus on preparing for the exam should be class notes. Very simply, the class content. If you have missed the class or if you were sick, please get the notes from somebody, or better yet, from two, because two witnesses is always better than one. And just copy those notes so that you have the class content. The other important part is your Bible reading itself, so the content of the book of Acts. Because I've already told you that you will need to write an outline of the book of Acts, so that you know is coming. And let me repeat again what I mean by outline, because it will be again stated in this way in the exam, and you may have some questions. And really, that's the thing. You will not be able to ask Deborah Kim questions. I have not instructed her, and so you need to pay attention now. By outline, I mean one characteristic aspect for each chapter. So it is very simple. For instance, if you write for chapter 2, Pentecost, that's sufficient. If you encounter a chapter that has two or three themes in that chapter, because the chapter divisions do not really follow the flow of thought of the book of Acts, then you can choose one of them, even though it doesn't characterize the whole chapter, one of a sub-point is sufficient as well. So that's the minimum. If, however, you want to write more, be my guest. So you can go into the last little verse divisions and write the whole thing out, if that's what you really are anxious to do. But the requirement is one characteristic main or subpoint for each chapter. Okay, so that you already know, and you can use various tools. For instance, some Bibles have fairly useful headings for chapters. You can use that. Or Bible study manuals, there are acrostics, there are all kinds of different learning tools. But if you just use your own Bible and look through the chapters, the headings, and just what you have read yourself, that should be sufficient. So only go to your Marshall reading, completing that, reviewing that, when you've done that. Marshall will not be very strongly emphasized. The core of my questions are concerning class content. There will be a good section on true-false statements, and I really do not try to trick you into finesse of words to kind of get you to try to be nervous. I'm trying to be as clear as possible. Sometimes in the test you will see that a word is put in italics. Take that very literally and follow that, because I'm making an emphasis. So that would be an important thing for you to follow. And otherwise, it should be a straightforward. I'm not trying to give you trick questions. It is really has the purpose of bringing together the factual learning, particularly in the true-false sections. Then there will be the section on the outline of the book of Acts. There will be some Bible content on book of Acts, some questions concerning that. And then I will conclude with one essay question. And that essay question, I will give you exact instruction as to how much space you can use. Half a page, I don't know exactly how much space I give you. Please follow that. My advice to you is, you will be able to do the factual part of the exam rather quickly, I think. Then for the essay question, you may want to write a page or two on a notepad, just jot down your thoughts and everything you know about to answer that question, and then transfer it to an answer to that question in the space allowed, and give me an extract, distill it down. So I don't know if you've ever been involved in the process of producing maple syrup, that if you have drunk what comes out of the tree, it's really a watered down sauce. It barely tastes like maple syrup and has to go through a process of quite some fire and distilling before you have this nice little container of pure maple syrup. That's what I'd like for you to go through a little bit. Now, some of you just have this gift of putting something out on half a page of paper and it's like ready for print. There's nothing that needs to be changed. Do that. But for others, I would advise you to do that process, because otherwise you'll say, that's so frustrating. I know more about this and I've only got, say, half a page or a page. That's really horrible. I should have as much space as possible to write 10 pages because this is really a fun question. I can draw things together. I want to say more. Well, do that. Be my guest. But then put it into the cage and really try and see what can I leave out? How can I formulate that so that it's really a concise statement? One reason for that is when you're in a conversation, and I have drawn a question out of these classes that may arise in a conversation with somebody who is interested in the Christian faith, you will not have the time to just go and have free-flowing thought for 2 hours about your subject. You may have to do exactly that. Give a concise statement with some really important points that bear on that subject. So let me suggest that to you. The time frame is not very wide, but it's not very restrictive. You should be able to do a good job in that time. So that's basically the format, a little bit of factual, a little bit of synthetic. The synthetic, you can draw on a lot of what we have done. And with that exam, then, we are concluding our study of the book of Acts, and then we're going to branch out, as I've told you, from that platform of an airport into the various areas of the Pauline epistles and how they relate to the book of Acts, how they relate to the chronology of Paul. Now, some of you see in here that I did write down review in small groups. That's a little bit of a change of action. You may still want to do that and come a little earlier. Originally, I had planned to have that review start at 6 and then for the exam to start at 7, but that will not work out. So we have to start our exam at 6 o'clock, but I would warmly encourage you to maybe come at 5 and one or two sit together. More than 3, you normally start to talk about the weather, so the discipline and the weather is good or bad, you know, so. But if you want to do that, I think that's wonderful, just to compare and say what do you know about this subject and exchange a little bit. Not to get each other more nervous, but just to concentrate a little together. So I encourage you to do that, but that needs to happen before 6 o'clock so that you can begin with the exam at 6. Are there any questions on that procedure? I want it to be a learning experience, and I do feel that both factual and conceptual integrative type of work is what is needed to concentrate your learning, and I hope it will be applicable for your future work. Yes? And the second one? No Bibles. There will be no tools allowed. So, and in fact, you can use, I think there should be enough space even on the exam itself to write the outline, etc. Your first question on the study of Marshall, I want you to look at the greater lines in Marshall, not the footnotes and the particular details. So just try to understand what's going on in this chapter, in this section. I think that should be sufficient. Some of you have found that there are some study questions on Marshall, but I think that's too intense of an exposure. I just wanted you to be exposed to this argumentation and line of argumentation, and for you to get a sense why it is important to engage in that kind of a discussion. I know it's not probably not your favorite bedtime reading, so that's how I would suggest. Just a major. You mean you're using it for instead of a sleeping pill? Well, it's better for your stomach, actually. There are no acids there. Other questions? Yes, please. When we get to the missionary journeys, just the cities, or what did you say at the end? Statement, what happens? I think I used the word characterizing and it would be hard for you to characterize by simply saying Paul is checking in Corinth or Paul checking in at Ephesus. So it would be good to characterize what he's doing or what is happening. So remember the word characterize. And characterize must be specific enough to give you an idea of that chapter. Because obviously you can summarize a lot of the book of Acts by simply saying, Paul journeys through the ancient world. and just give me dots for each chapter that applies to, you know. And he's a great man and he does a wonderful job. Yes, please. On your notes from the class, what kind of questions? Yes, it will be true or false questions on your notes, but also the essay question will pertain to all your notes that you have taken. And that's a little bit of a synthetic attempt to draw various points together and for you to both refer to your reading of the book of Acts and what we have discussed in class. So it's both a detailed true-false area where your class notes will come in, plus the more synthetic question. No short answer questions at this point. Yes. But I just don't want to insult your intellect by just giving you true-false. I think it's good to be held accountable for facts, but I just want to draw you a little bit into some synthetic. And synthetic doesn't mean that it's not natural. It means that you draw things together, that you combine and you reflect on how does this relate. Other questions? So don't be too nervous. My purpose is really to draw it together, to make this part of your total learning experience rather than a nightmare, that you will forget everything we have said about Acts, but you will not forget the nightmare of the exam. That would be exactly the wrong thing.